I call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, take your seats. Chair recognizes a quorum. Members, today we'll be making technical and procedural motions on three bills to move them out of committee back to the general register. Following that, it is Lucero Day in the Judiciary Committee. We've got three Representative Lucero bills, 1821, 2232, and House File 103. But before that, and I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 19th. Representative Albright moves the minutes. Any discussion? All in favor of the minutes February 19th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of February 19th are approved. So next we're moving on to our technical and procedural votes. That first being House File 2001, Workforce Certificates of Compliance Supplying Equally to In-State and Out-of-State Contractors. Representative Cantrell, this is your bill, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move House File 2001 to be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, I believe there is an amendment.
There is. Okay, it's the A4 amendment. Does everyone have a copy of the A4? Okay, in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is amended. Any discussion on House File 2001 as amended? Okay, one second. Let me do a quick count here. Oh, we're good. Right? Yeah, okay. All right. All in favor of re-referring House File 2001 to Ways and Means as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Next. Is Representative Hassan here? Does somebody want to move? Okay. Representative Hassan moves House File 1511 that it be recommended to be placed on the general register. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. House File 1511 is referred to the general, placed on the general register. Next is House File 1521. Chair Scott moves that House File 1521 be recommended to be placed in the general register. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Chair Scott's 1521 is placed on the general register. Representative Lucero, are you ready to go? And by the way, thank you for not disappointing me on your loud jacket today.
It's not loud enough, though.
It's
not
loud. It goes to 11. The first bill we have up for consideration is House File 1821, Student Data Privacy Act Created and Penalties Provided. Representative Lucero, would you like to move your bill and recommend it to be re-referred to the Education Policy Committee?
So moved, Mr.
Chair. Okay, that is the motion before us. And you have two amendments, is that right, Representative Lucero?
I do, Mr. Chair, but before that, I've got some goodies.
Oh, wow. What? He's got goodies, and he's not even a freshman.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like, if you would like to make this official, but maybe February 20th of every year could be officially Eric Lucero Day.
You know, decreed by legislative fiat, February 20th is Eric Lucero Day. We all have to find out where he shops for his clothes and buy something there.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for this. I did bring in the goodies, not because I need to, because I'm in my third term, but because I'm just a great guy, and I hope everybody enjoys this. But in fact, actually, studies have proven, cross-sectional, longitudinal, double-blinded studies have scientifically proven that this committee is the best committee in the Minnesota House. So,
I will take judicial notice of that point.
So I do have the First Amendment technical. I would move the A20-0622 amendment, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, no, it's the A1 amendment. It's the technical one.
Yeah, you're moving the A1 first. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A1 is adopted. Then to your A20-0622 amendment, Representative Lucero.
Yes, I move that, and this is seeking to narrow in scope the curriculum that we'll discuss as part of this bill. So I would move that.
Okay, any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A20-0622 amendment is adopted. So Representative Lucero, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'm just going to do a quick walkthrough, and then I do have at least one testifier. So the background is technology has advanced rapidly in the last decade plus. And that technology and those enhancements are, have obviously made them their way into the classroom. And they have greatly benefited students in the educational process. But because the law is not keeping up with technology, there needs to have a conversation, which is this legislation before us, to begin to contain or put some controls in place to ensure that parents are indeed have authority over their students' private data. And so with that background, a walkthrough here. Looking at section two of the bill, number two, the scope of this bill applies to public and private I got so many bills, Mr. Chair. I am
zero day.
Looking at section two, it applies to K through 12 public and private schools. Subdivision 13, technology providers are an extension of the government entity. That's what the reference to Chapter 1305, Subdivision 11 is. Letter B is data is the property of the school and not the technology providers. Letter C, starting in line 3.1, that is a reference to the breach notification in Chapter 13.055. Letter D governs the return or the destruction of the data following the expiration of a contract and non-renewal. Letter E places limits on the use of the data on the technology provider. Letter F prohibits no marketing of the data. Beginning letter G, lines 1 and 2 of the specify that a technology provider must have a security policy in place. Letter F references the contracts, and it includes proactive notification to contracts to the parents now. It empowers parents with their rights, and it increases accountability by having the contracts between the schools and the technology providers available to parents. Letter I governs the ability to inspect those contracts, and then letter J is that students who decide to opt out are not penalized for exercising their right to opt out. Beginning in subdivision 14, this puts prohibitions on what the school can do with the technology. And it prohibits the school from location tracking. So if a laptop, for example, has the ability to be tracked, the school can't use that to track the student's location. Laptops today, obviously, they have microphones and video capabilities. So this says that the school is not permitted to enable the audio or visual capabilities. The next section is keystrokes and web browsing monitoring are prohibited. And then there's exceptions to the above prohibitions. And the exceptions are if the student initiates and agrees. So, for example, if a student participates in some kind of a web conference, right, they're going to be able to, they've initiated that communication, and now the school would be able to track that. Another exception would be if it's part of a legal process, right? If there's a legal process in place, that the school then obviously would be permitted to track the location, look at the audio visual, or monitor the keystrokes or web browsing. Third exception is if the technology is lost or stolen. We obviously then, if it's possible, to enable location tracking to try to recover a device. And then the fourth exception is that if there's a threat to life or safety, then we would be, or schools would be able to monitor the web browsing activity, et cetera, et cetera. Now, by the way, I should, by way of background, I have been working on student data privacy since my first term. And so we've been through numerous committees, and the product we see before us now is a product of multiple stakeholders, multiple committees, trying to refine this language, and that's how we've come to this exception. For example, these exceptions to ensure that schools do have the ability to use these capabilities if needed to track students and make sure they're safe, et cetera. Letter C is a notice articulating if the above exceptions are exercised, that within 72 hours, notice must be given. So, for example, if there is a lost or stolen device, or if there's a threat to life or safety, and therefore the GPS has to be enabled right away, that within 72 hours, the school must notify the parents that that has happened. Then we get to subdivision 15, and as I mentioned, this applies to K-12 public and private schools. It does not, this bill does not apply to post-secondary schools. And that's what letter C of subdivision 15 specifies. Higher education is not included. So with that, Mr. Chair, I do have at least one testifier.
Please have your testifier join us at the table. Ms. Decker, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Julia Decker. I'm the policy director for the ACLU of Minnesota. As Representative Lucero noted, technology is developing these days at a really rapid pace, and with that come a lot of benefits as well as a lot of new challenges for protecting people's data and information. Whether it's banking, retail, or as relates to this bill, education, data is often being generated, collected, and circulated faster than privacy protections can be assessed and put in place. Sensitive personal information about students that used to exist on paper, locked away in the principal's office, is now being uploaded onto third-party cloud-based servers. Students are also now getting devices such as iPads, which offer really great educational benefits, but also have the potential, as Representative Lucero noted, to be used to track a student's location or their browsing history, or even remotely access a webcam. I think there's growing bipartisan consensus that we need to bring our digital privacy laws into the 21st century, and House Bill 1821, with its focus on student data privacy, is a solid step in the right direction. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions for Ms. Decker? Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucero. This looks pretty good. My only question is, does this fall in what would be customary and usual, or is this, are we taking new steps to help protect this? Just like know where we are, I don't.
Representative
Lucero. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Considine. That's, my background is cybersecurity. I didn't mention that up front. I've been doing this for 15 years. And what I would hope as a security practitioner would be common sense and just stuff that we do without being prompted to. Unfortunately, we've seen both in the private sector and the public sector doesn't happen. And so in this case, technology just, you know, we meet for roughly 5 months out of the year. Since we adjourned last year, the amount of technology capabilities that have innovated and then that have been adopted and brought into the classroom happens so rapidly that putting controls in place hasn't necessarily kept pace, and that's what we're trying to do. So the private sector has done many of these things, and just seeking to ensure the same for our K-12 students.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Decker? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I just have a couple questions with regard to the definitions regarding school-issued devices. And I'm wondering if you could just point to the section where it would relate to. I understand about if it is a school-issued device, but in most cases, the personalization of personal devices also can accommodate access to curricula within the school itself. What safeguards and or measures does this bill address in terms of the invasive nature of curricula onto personal devices?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that's an excellent question because as we're seeing, there's two scenarios. The one is it's a school-issued device, as you mentioned, of which the software is obviously installed. And then you have the personal device, which would be the hardware, that is then used to either browse the web or have software installed on it. The scope of this is school-issued device. And so that is another great question. That's a challenge of where does the line get drawn, because it's difficult to mandate when it's a personal device. And we have the same challenges in the private sector. If a person brings in their private phone and attaches that and has company email now on it, now the lines have been blurred. And so that's why I think that's a further conversation and refining this when we have more of the gray areas rather than the black and white areas. But we definitely want to start with this and then progress into that. But if, okay.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that extent, you know, remote access, and you identify with the application a non-public school exemption in subdivision 15. But I'm also then curious, particularly for juniors and seniors in high school, how this would be applicable to going to a secondary educational opportunity through PSEO. How does that, are we still within the purview of student, and so it would be applicable, even though they're using their personal device, going back to my earlier question? And maybe this is something that we can work on offline, but I find this very intriguing because the issue of data privacy is paramount. And but if you have an answer now, I would appreciate hearing it. If not, I look forward to sharing some work possibly in the future with you. Thank you.
Why don't we do this? We got a bunch of questions lined up, but we've got several other testifiers. I'd like us to maybe get through those first. But did you want to go ahead and take a shot at that first?
I would just say, please, let's work between now and the next stop. I definitely want feedback on how we can continue to refine this to ensure that our children are safe. But just in general, if it's a school-issued device, we want to make sure that the controls are in place for school-issued devices. Now, when we get into other scenarios, it definitely is going to require further exploring, for sure.
Okay, who else is going to testify on this bill? Raise your hand back there. Okay. We've got Linda Bell. Okay, and then I've got Elizabeth Banghart. Where is Elizabeth?
She's been delayed in traffic because of some late school starts
area. So. All right, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this bill? One, two, three. I see three hands up. Is there four? Who said four? Raise your hands high if you're going to testify on this. Okay, I see three. All right, thanks. Go ahead, Ms. Bell, introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Lesh and committee members. Good morning. My name is Linda Bell. I'm a mother, wife, been a longtime public school teacher, and have a small private business. My husband also teaches in the public schools. We as teachers and parents are very concerned about student data and would like to speak today primarily about the third-party contracts and the sharing and selling of student data. I am in support of this bill. In 2014, my husband's school was hit with a data breach, which affected almost all of the staff members. A small amount of information was breached, we were told, such as name, address, phone number, email, and insurance information. We quickly changed account numbers and passwords. A few months later, we filed our tax returns and found out our IRS accounts had been hacked, and shortly after, our bank accounts were hacked. And we found that we were the recipients of identity theft. The IRS told us through our lengthy time working with them that our accounts were hacked a few days after the data breach occurred. So we found that there was some connection. It took nearly a year to completely recover our identities with the IRS and invest in permanent identity theft protection. For some people, it's not always this easy. We stand with those who believe that an individual's identity or a child's identity is theirs and theirs alone. The story of our data breach serves as an example of what happens when a school's third-party technology provider shares and sells a student's data. Our school data breach released our personally identifiable information, which is the same thing that occurs with third-party technology companies. They do have access or can quickly get access to all identifying information, including a family's financial information, which is tied to student data. The largest share of income for technology providers, and this has been proven many times, you've seen it in the news, and through lawsuits, the largest share of income for technology providers comes from the selling of data or identities, not products or services. Once that student's private information gets out into the digital world, there are all kinds of possibilities for bad behavior. Many technology companies already work across the country and therefore are accustomed to working with multiple states' privacy laws. Importantly, we can tighten up the sharing and selling of data without getting in the way of the school's technology programs, and HF 1821 serves as a model to do just that. Other highlights I'd like to bring to your attention, line 2.29, who owns the data? Very important. Line 2.32, how to handle a data breach. Line 3.4, how and when data must be destroyed when a contract with a school is being dissolved. And then line 3.8, prohibitions on the sale of data. This bill will bring much needed first time protections for students and families, very simply by helping students implement best practices for handling data. I encourage you to vote in favor of House File 1821 to protect a student's data and in the end, their identities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bell. Next testifier. Who's up next? We're not doing questions till the end, just so we get through our testifiers. I don't have her name. Thank you. Oh, in opposition. Okay. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tracy Brovold, and I am the Director of Educational Technology for Mankato Area Public Schools. And I am here today as a board member and on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The safety and security of our students is of utmost importance to us. It includes the privacy of our student data. In review of this bill, there are three areas that we'd like to address. The first is the technology providers or vendors section. It is in all of our best interests to safeguard the student information that we have been entrusted with. Protecting data is important and it ought to be done through proper contract management. The Children's Online Protection Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, is a law that already exists and it's in place for dealing with how websites, apps, and other online operators work in conjunction with us to determine what our contracts are and put that contract language into place. The first portions of this bill do address a provider's requirements in safeguarding student data. We agree that these are contractual agreements that would work towards the goal of effective and safe use. The second portion of the bill is the opt-out provision for parents. The bill states that schools would be required to provide opt-outs for parents to any program where a technology provider has access to educational data. If parents opt out, it doesn't make the rest of the data safer. It just allows the systems to be less effective and creates difficulties when we're trying to access educational information. For example, if we allow students to opt out of systems that allow us to look at educational data to make data-driven decisions about classroom instruction, the teacher no longer has the full picture of what's happening in that classroom and of the students in that room. This will hurt the teacher's ability to make data-driven decisions and lessen the overall learning experience for our students. If parents opt out of our student information system, we would experience issues such as difficulty contacting parents, getting a hold of them, issues running report cards, issues determining class rank, providing scheduling, giving schedules to our students, and reporting to the Minnesota Department of Education. The third area I would like to address is the section on school-issued devices. First and most important is the fact that monitoring of student technology is prohibited within this bill, but required as part of Federal Children's Internet Protection Act, or CIPA, for E-rate funding. Schools must certify in order to receive E-rate funding that they have an internet safety policy in place that includes protection measures of technology. The protection measures must block or filter our internet access. Additionally, those internet safety policies must monitor the online activities of minors, and minors in SIPA are described as 17 and under. Schools and libraries who are subject to SIPA may not receive the discounts offered by the federal E-rate program if they don't comply with these laws. And in 2019, Minnesota schools received approximately $30 million from federal E-rate programs. Additionally, if schools can't monitor use, it poses a significant issue and potentially puts our students more at risk. There have been times when our ability to monitor students has alerted us to immediate threat of students intending to harm themselves or others. If we decide to not allow monitoring, we are turning a blind eye to those students and their needs. Finally, pursuant to Minnesota statute, school lockers are the property of the school district. Students do not have an absolute expectation of privacy in their lockers, as the school district reserves the right to inspect them at any time. This should not be any different with a school-issued device. Overall, we strongly believe student safety and data privacy is of utmost importance to our school districts. We also believe this legislation is already covered in the laws I mentioned, SIPA and COPA. It does not make sense to duplicate laws that are already in place and make it harder for education to happen. The unintended consequences of this bill could impact teaching and learning, our classrooms, systems we have in place for communications with families, and overall systems that allow our schools and classrooms to run effectively. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Bravo. Mm-hmm. Next, who's our next testifier? Welcome to the committee. Please reintroduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm going to come at it from the technology provider side. I represent the CompTIA, Computing Technology Industry Association. We're a national trade association that lobbies on IT issues. We also are known for our professional certification programs. As a matter of fact, the gentleman to the left of me is a certified CompTIA IT professional. Mr. Chairman, members of our organization that work in the educational arena, their number one priority is the protection of student data privacy. And all our members sign what's known as the K-12 School Service Provider Pledge to safeguard student data privacy. And it's a two-page document, and I'm not going to get into all the intricacies of it, but the important parts are if the pledge is to not sell student data information, personal information, make sure that there's no retention of student data beyond contract obligations, and no advertising to students, Mr. Chairman. But to turn to the bill, one of my points has already been made by the previous testifier, but if to draw your attention to, Mr. Chairman, on 3.5 to 3.8 of the bill, it talks about destroying data at the end of a contract, and it doesn't specify what type of data. So we were just, we're going to keep working with Representative Lucero. He's had a great open door policy over the years that he and I have talked about student data privacy. And to just go through and clarify that data, whether it's identifiable data or non-identifiable data, Mr. Chairman. The second concern of ours is from 3.16 to 3.22, where we must establish written procedures to ensure security safeguards among our employees and then interaction with the student data privacy. We have internal protocols that we'll set up there, but if you look on 3.23, that then becomes public data. So our internal protocols and how we're going to interact and try and protect this data is now become public data, and we worry that folks that might not have student data privacy in their, they have bad intentions, now have our internal protocols on how to protect that student data. Mr. Chairman, another point on 4.4 and 4.5, it talks about an educational institution must provide parents and students a complete copy of the contract between the technology provider and the school district. We're concerned there's going to be proprietary information in those contracts. And so we want to work with Representative Lucero to make sure that that proprietary information is not public. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, the previous testifier mentioned we're worried about specifically on lines 4.13, where it talks about access and monitor. We're worried about if that is in conflict with the Children's Internet Protection Act and the E-rate program, because as she pointed out, there are protection measures that must be required, and then it also requires monitoring of online activities of minors and also educating minors about online behavior such as cyberbullying. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stick around for any questions and let other testifiers. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Poulos. Next testifier? I know we had one more raise their hand.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bill Hudson. I am the head of school at Mounds Park Academy in Maplewood, Minnesota. And I am speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Independent Schools. We have 17 independent schools in the state of Minnesota, from Shattuck, St. Mary's in the south to Marshall and Great Rivers in the north, and several here in the Twin Cities metro area. And we would just like to speak on behalf of our students and our school. We share the same concern about student data and student privacy. We have a sacred trust with our families that are a part of our schools, and we share that concern to protect their student privacy. What we would add, and as it was mentioned earlier, a primary concern for me would be by students opting out of this would be the time that it takes from the student contact that the teacher has with the student, the paperwork, the ability to communicate with parents, the ability to make instructional decisions without that data and without that relationship with parents that these third-party contracts provide would really limit and, I think, diminish the kind of relationship and the services that we can provide to our families. And that's really, from the heart of a teacher, one of the things that concerns me. I would also say that we have as independent schools, and all of our 17 members are accredited by the Independent School Accrediting Commission of the of Central States, we do have standards that we have to maintain relative to data privacy and record keeping. And this would be, as a part of our accreditation, we'd have to demonstrate that to Isaacs. We also, as an independent school, we have our own layers of scrutiny that we provide as a independent school. We have an independent board of trustees, and for instance at Mounds Park Academy we have a committee, audit committee, that looks at enterprise risk management, that has examined third-party contracts with our vendors, has provided the level of scrutiny that we are comfortable with the measures that are in place. And there's a number of those that, for example, the COPA safe harbor certification that exists that protects the student data. We also, and part of the opt-in, opt-out is concerning, as our relationships with parents are driven by their enrollment contract, where they do opt-in to the use of the student data. They opt-in to the different databases that we use to communicate and house student data. The data does belong to the families, and these databases, these vendors house that and enable us to make those decisions to serve the students best. And so we have been satisfied with that, and that the ability to opt in and opt out already exists in independent schools because of the contract that we establish when the family enrolls in the independent schools. So those are just a few thoughts on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Independent Schools. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for your concern for the student data. We really appreciate that.
Thank you, Dr. Hudson. We do have a fourth one. Now, Mr. Harris, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Shep Harris. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Independent School Forum. You could say we're kind of cousins to the Minnesota Association of Independent Schools, but slightly different. It's a 40-year-old organization that represents over 100 schools here in Minnesota, and we do appreciate the efforts, and we agree with the efforts, the motivation of trying to protect student data. But I also wanted to, I'm representing Tim Benz, who's the executive director of that association, who happens to also be the chair of the Non-Public Education Council. And so he wanted, couldn't be here today, but wanted me to convey a couple quick items, Mr. Chair, and that is, for starters, the Non-Public Education Council does not accredit, they do not accredit the schools. They identify organizations like ISACs that authorize the schools. So there's some work that's needed on this bill. And there's also a concern about, well, for starters, we have to change the title and the language, which can easily be done. What I would say is there's a question in Section 3 about government entities. I'm assuming that's a public education entity or a public education agency. I would imagine that would have to be altered just to be consistent with the rest of the bill. So we agree with many of the points that Dr. Hudson made, but we wanted to just point those minor issues out. And frankly, invite Representative Lucero to come to the Non-Public Education Council where he can hear from a spectrum of non-public schools to hear whether or not we believe that the bill is actually necessary. So we do appreciate the time and look forward to working with Representative Lucero and the rest of the committee on this issue.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Just a quick question, Ms. Harris. Independent schools, does that mean what the rest of us think of, private schools?
Yes, sir.
But it's rebranded. Okay, I get it. Just want to make sure. Thank you. Anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 1821 as amended? Seeing none, then going to questions from members. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, my question was answered.
It was. Excellent. See, that's the point of bringing up the testifiers first. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lucero, I had a question for you about lines 2.21 to 2.22. And I definitely understand and appreciate what the bill is doing with respect to actual devices that students are receiving, but this question relates to the portion that says that a technology provider includes providing access to a software or online application. And I know as a parent whose son is just in college now, there are a lot of different programs. Our school uses Navitas to help students navigate the college world. You know, they can provide ACT exams and SAT exam scores to other colleges. They can do their SAT subject tests, and I'm worried about being able for students to be able to provide that information to other institutions and use that software in a way that's good for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at lines 5.15 and 5.16, the intent was not to prevent post-secondary institutions from being able to access or market to college students or where that information that was up submitted in a website, for example, that you provided in the hypothetical, that they would be able to use that information to talk to students. So if this language isn't enough, we definitely want to make sure that higher post-secondary institutions do have availability to the information.
Yep. Thank you for that. And maybe we can talk offline a little bit more about that. That would be great. And then the other thing was just something that the testifiers brought out, and specifically with lines 4.12 to 4.13, again, the government entity being able to access the students, like keyboard strokes or things like that on these devices. I've had criminal cases where a student was looking at some inappropriate things on one of their school-issued devices, and so that was really important that the school be able to monitor something like that. So I just want to make sure that we're not prohibiting schools from being able to follow kinds of those sorts of things that a student might be doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, there was a fifth exception, and it was to enforce the school's acceptable use policy. I'm seeing it's not in this draft, but it was in previous iterations, so I'm thinking in the multiple changes that particular exception would have was dropped, and I definitely want to add that back in, because a school's acceptable use policy then would include not browsing pornography, not going to dangerous or hate websites, things like that, and so then schools would be able to monitor to enforce a school's acceptable use policy, so that with that fifth exception, I think that covers everything, all the scenarios the stakeholders had brought in the past.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if you kind of crafted this looking at a national model, and if not, can you just talk about the stakeholder process a bit? Because we had four testifiers that had to me they sounded rather significant concerns, and I'm just wondering, have they been at the table, or what exactly is happening there in the stakeholder process?
Absolutely. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So back in 2015, it started with the ACLU, with parent-driven organizations, and then the technology on one side. So that wasn't based off of a national model. This is organically driven. Actually, that's not entirely true. The ACLU did provide some template language, which we use as a foundation, but we built upon it. And then the other side, which would be the technology providers, the schools, and others, since 2015, we've been going back and forth and back and forth and refining and adding and addressing concerns to where we see it today. So this is, again, I think this is the fourth or fifth committee that we've gone through and refined. And so to address some of the concerns, I've heard repeatedly that we're from multiple testifiers that we're already doing this. We're already doing this voluntarily. We have pledges to do this. Well, if you're doing it voluntarily, then great. For those that are not doing it, we need to lift the bottom up. We need to create a standard to lift everybody up. So if you're already doing it, you're not going to be impacted. But for those that are not doing these provisions, we definitely need to make sure that across the board in our 330-plus school districts, public anyway, and then adding on top of the private, are all following the same rules. Another that I heard was the opt-out. So I heard testifiers say that we're concerned about the ability to empower parents to opt out, but at the same time, we're concerned about, so we don't want to give people the option to opt out, and then we don't want to, we're concerned about limiting where the information or how technology providers would use the information. And so I don't want to put parents in a position where they have no choice, right? If they have to use it for the curriculum and then they don't have control over where the information is going, that's not a win-win. So we definitely want to empower parents. Now, I heard these same conversations in the industry. If you recall Sarbanes-Oxley applies to publicly traded U.S.-based companies. I heard the same thing when HIPAA and high-tech regulatory compliance mandates were being discussed. The same things of we're already doing this or this will have an impact, it'll increase the burden. When it came to PCI, payment card industry, so credit card numbers. For this private and personal information, whether it be health records, whether it be Social Security numbers, whether it be financial data, so the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, whether it be any of this health information. The conversations have taken place, but we've been able to get over it. We've been able to work through it. We've been able to adapt, and other states are doing this. I point to California. Just last year, they enacted a very, in my opinion, good bill that empowers consumers to have the decision-making over their own information. And so we want to accomplish the same thing here in schools. If there are some concerns, like I said, the acceptable use policy, legitimate, we need to add that exception. When it comes to, again, the locker example, I'll just go back to that. So that is decades old precedent. But a student, so the locker is owned by the schools, and so the student doesn't have an expectation of privacy, but the student can decide what to put in and out of a locker. Right, so if they choose not to put stuff in a locker, then it wouldn't be susceptible to be searched by the school. They have the choice. But when it comes to a laptop or a school-issued device, if, hey, student, you have no choice but to use this, and now you have no expectation of privacy, where's the empowerment? So we need to make sure that parents are empowered.
Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you for that. I had two very specific questions from the bill itself, and on page 3, both of one thing I heard was specifically on line 3.23 through 3.24, talking about what's public and what's private data, and I heard the phrase "the bad actors will now know what we're up to" and the policies and all that. So, can you just talk a little bit about the data classification and how are you going to determine that, and how are we going to make sure that those that have nefarious means and motives out there are not getting information that they should not?
Mr. Lucero.
I think that was a fair point that the testifier made. So making the acceptable use policy public data probably isn't necessary. And I think that we can work through making, so it requiring that the security policy is in place and mandating some of the elements that must be in a technology provider's security policy, I think that's good enough. But then to make that security policy public, yeah, I agree with that testimony.
And one final question.
O'Neill, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then there was, I think it was Ms. Brovold that had mentioned that if they opt out, then they'll lose contact with the parents, so they won't have the connection for the parent's name and telephone number and all of that. Can you address that concern? But the basic information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's the student information system, SIS. So that would be like a global catalog. But a school uses software to put that information in. Is that information going to the technology provider? Or is that staying with the school? So if it's staying with the school as a global catalog, like for, I would just use our email address books. So we here at the house, right, we are familiar with, in Outlook, we have an address book. That information is not going out to other places. So utilizing technology such as the student information system, I don't think was a good example, which was cited here, because that's going to stay within the school district. But if it's going and being shared with other places, yeah, that is concerning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Herr.
My question has been answered, Chair.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Lucero, for bringing this bill up. I think consumer rights for privacy data information that is being collected, when it comes to the students, we're not doing a lot. In fact, you referenced the California bill. We do have House File 3096. It's modeled based on several states that have introduced. If this bill is somehow a difficult bill, then people will be running away from 3096 because we need to protect the data that we provide online. As a programmer, somebody who is an IT, I know how much data we collect. And we don't tell the students or consumers what we're collecting about them. Unless we are upfront and tell them this is the data we're collecting and we're going to sell it and we will provide to anybody who is asking for that information without the consent of that individual, we're losing our rights. So I encourage you to even include the enforcement. There's no enforcement in this bill. We need to empower the individual to have the right, right of action. And also we need to bring in the Attorney General because data is becoming now the goal for many things. So I encourage you to, you know, add the consumer protection when it comes to this bill. So I'm hoping that you will include the Attorney General for enforcement in this process.
I appreciate the feedback, and definitely I want the stakeholders and others, please, let's submit some feedback so I can incorporate that into the next amendment.
Thank you. Last question is from Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Chair Lesh, and thank you, Representative Lucero, for bringing this bill forward. I just wanted to touch on a point that you made, and that, even 5-6 years ago, laptops were optional for students to use, right? But at this point in time, more and more schools, I know of some myself, are completely paperless, completely. They don't have physical textbooks anymore. You have no option but to use laptops. And in a time when data, it has become really one of the most sought after commodities in any marketplace and really in any arena, making sure that we are protecting student privacy and student data, I think, has to be a paramount concern. And that, I think, is part of the reason why this bill is necessary. It's to modernize, really, our approach to student data privacy and protection. One thing I wanted to ask you is, could you outline for us maybe some examples as to why this bill is necessary? Examples in which under current policy in the past, there has been malfeasance on behalf of perhaps either school districts or anything like that. What I want to really understand is what are the examples of the past, what are we trying to fix, and where are we moving to?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So In past bill hearings, when we've had more time, I had a multi-slide PowerPoint that I presented with. I don't know how many here have seen that presentation, but it included data breaches. I had examples of government data breaches from schools, from multiple agencies. I've had examples of school districts. I've had many more moms that were down here, I think, what, four or five testifiers at one time, testifying how school districts have been breached. It didn't make the big headlines, but it involved their children's private data. I'm trying to think of one of the examples was it a school bus? I think it was a school bus, the route where it was sent to everybody in the school district and the dates and times and locations of the students. And so that went to everybody. And now, is that a security threat? Now knowing where you, so everybody knows now where your child is going to be at a particular point and bus stop and the time. And it was just multiple examples. And so we need to put controls in place. Additional examples, not necessarily in the state of Minnesota, but limited to the state of Minnesota, but technology providers using information. And we know big data is a multi-billion-dollar industry. Multi-billion-dollar industry. And so collecting all this information, data mining it, creating profiles, selling, transferring. It could be transferred and shared with third parties without being sold, right? So I've heard some testifiers, not necessarily today, but in the past have said, we're not selling the data. Okay, well, you can still share it with third parties without selling it to a subsidiary, and who knows how the relationships between business entities go. And that then puts the information collected on students in the hands of others without parents' knowledge or permission. And so there are numerous examples, which I spared this committee the longer presentation, but yes, definitely, they're out there.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. There being no other discussion before the committee, the motion has been made that House File 1821, as amended, be re-referred to the Education Policy Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. You're on your way, Representative Lucero.
Your Thank
next
you.
Bill is House File 2232. And your motion on that is that it be re-referred to the Higher Ed Policy Committee. Is that your motion, Representative Lucero?
It is, Mr. Chair.
And you have two amendments on this as well. You've got first the A20-0623. Do you offer that amendment, Representative Lucero?
I do.
Okay, does everyone have a copy? Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. The A20-0632 amendment is adopted. Your next amendment, Representative Lucero, is the A20-0616. Do you offer that amendment?
So moved.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A20-0616 amendment is adopted. Representative Lucero, to your bill as amended, you have two testifiers. Is that right?
I do, Mr. Chair. And I'm actually going to go, I'm going to speak to the amendment first, the A 2616. I'm going to walk through that because it's significantly larger than the.
You want to is Cass Weiland your first testifier?
Yes. If you want to do the testifiers first,
we can. Cass Weiland, come on down here while you explain that. Go ahead. Go ahead, Representative Lucero. Explain that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Cass Weiland. I am a cybersecurity consultant and privacy consultant too. I just wanted to offer my support for this bill because. One of the things I give out to my prospective clients is a list of 150 or so, it changes, websites that I call them people searching websites, and they're websites where you put in their someone's name and you can and they spit out your address and phone number and email and all sorts of scary information. And this, it's the consequences of having personal information like the information that this college institutions give out, having that information public, this is where they get that information from. So if you're like whitepages.com, they go and they scrape public information from tax records, criminal records, and public records from schools and higher education stuff. That's how they populate these websites, and that's how they build these databases. It's not just marketing information that they sell back and forth between themselves, like with LexisNexis. It's also, let's go to people.com to look up someone and see where they live and what their phone number is. You know, most of you have probably seen the movie Terminator, where the Terminator looks up some Sarah Connor's address in the Yellow Pages. Used to be you could, if you wanted to be a little private, all you had to do is get your contact Yellow Pages and say, hey, can you take me out of your, off of your listing? Nowadays, I've got 150 websites where you got to contact and say, hey, can you take me off of this thing? It's insane. So yeah, it's just, there should be a lot more thought put into what information these institutions are making public for anybody to download and scrape, because it is open season for stalkers and criminals and people who want to misuse this information. So,
okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Weiland. Any questions, any other questions for the committee from Mr. Weiland? Thank you. You have other testifiers too?
I do, Mr. Chair. I have several students from the U of M who can make their way down.
Come on,
and I would say that this bill was the origin of U of M students who approached me. I had been, they were alerted to the fact that my efforts in the K through 12 space for student data privacy, they came to me and said, Eric, we have similar concerns in the higher ed.
If you're U of M students, come down here and take the, are you at the Twin Cities campus?
Yes, sir.
Any of you know my daughter, Alice Lesh? She lives in Stanford. Well,
there are just a couple people on campus, but surprisingly, I haven't not met her yet.
She hasn't called me back in a week, so if you see her on campus, tell her to call her old man, okay? Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair. I promise to door knock in around the U.
So
it's in my district. I'll make sure that she calls
you. Yeah. Okay, I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Austin Kraft. I'm a fourth-year undergraduate student on the Twin Cities campus, originally from Savage, Minnesota. And I'm here to talk about House File 2232 before us today. I come from a family of teachers, and so I have grown up over the past two decades recognizing the immense ways just in my lifetime that education has changed, not just me as a student, but seeing my parents also adapt to changes in the classroom and on the administrative side of things as well. As technology has evolved, however, policy has not kept up to pace. And so I'm here today to testify in support of the language in House File 2232 as it advances and aligns with students' expectations when it comes to their privacy, particularly speaking on the post-secondary level. This issue is at the confluence of federal and state level policies in which public institutions currently are in a position in which, as the previous testifier explained, students' information is pretty much available to anyone who requests it. Directories of student information have definite use for internal processes for an institution, such as contacting students in the event of some emergency, or for external institutions if they want to, say, verify an applicant's enrollment status. But public access to that information, while maybe applicable several decades ago, when the directory was limited to a physical book that was used for students to connect with one another, now does not serve the same necessary function, nor is poses the same benefit to students. On the contrary, it can, for example, lead to receiving unwanted advertisements, information being, as the previous testifier explained, scraped, and potentially leading to instances of identity theft as technology advances. Adversaries are increasingly able to learn a lot from very little information. So it's imperative that institutions are thoughtful about what information is made publicly available. And the component addressing maintenance of documentation of these large requests is an act of transparency that students expect and deserve. I had the privilege of being the primary author on a resolution that went through the Minnesota Student Association, successfully passed just over a year ago, the demands of which strongly align with the language before us today. Recent provisions from FERPA also, these were in 2011, enable institutions to maintain directory information that is not public, so the stipulations made here would not be restricting the information that schools have and that schools, as I mentioned, have may have a need for. It's a privilege to speak before you all today. Thank you for this opportunity, and I look forward to Minnesota continuing to prioritize growing its efforts around the protection of student information at the post-secondary level. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Graff. Any questions for Mr. Graff? Thank you. Oh, Representative Cantrell.
Mr. Kraft, I'm retiring. Are you looking for a job? No.
I've got my hat in a few rings.
There you go. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony. One of the things that I actually did want to know a little bit more about is through this legislation, how do you personally view that student data privacy at the University of Minnesota, at post-secondary institutions across the state, might be improved and further secured? What kind of advancements are you hoping to come that will come from this legislation?
Absolutely.
Yeah, what that means is, so like when I say your name, it means you say Mr. Chair and then Representative Cantrell. It's a whole little game we play here, but it's just a... Anyway, yeah. So that's what that's about.
Yeah, Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Cantrell. Several years ago, actually, because this has been in the works among student advocates for several years now, several years ago, there was a student who just demonstrated for all of us how easy it was to scrape thousands of students' information by current policies about what's available. And so just one way in which I see it being improved is making that not as easy of an accomplishment to have. And I further see it as students being able to receive important communications and not for those to not be diluted by additional marketing emails coming at them, and also just the ability to focus on their studies when they're at school and not have to worry about someone with less than respectable intentions using the directory to find out where they live or contact them or harassing them by using this information that's currently possible to be accessed.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kraft.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kraft. Any other testifiers you got?
I do have one more testifier, and if I could just add to this. So he was specifically referring to lines 1.16 through 1.19. That was the directory information. And I'll just provide one example. So I recently, as a cybersecurity consultant, I recently had a client who the small business had on their website had published the officers, the senior officers, and then all of the mid-level staff, the employees of their business, included a picture, their first name, last name, obviously the business address, the business email address, and then their telephone number. Each individual employee's email address and telephone number, direct phone number, on the website. That information was scraped, and this company was constantly under spear phishing attacks, constantly, because they had all the information that the attackers needed. They had a picture, they knew the name, they had the job description, they had the direct email address, so they would spoof, for example, from the president to other members within the organization to wire transfer. There's just multiple examples. So having this information publicly available, student information, email address, if you look here on line 1.18, 1.19, email address, physical address, telephone number, identification card photograph, if that's available to parties outside of the university system, that is subjecting significant risk to our college students for identity theft and spear phishing attacks. Now, I did have concerns that they're not able to testify from higher ed, that they don't want to limit the transfer of this information to organizations such as housing. So, transfer of information, over 100 students or more to organizations for food purposes, et cetera, et cetera. And that is not the scope of this bill to limit that. So I'm going to be working with them to include, to ensure that that's still permitted. But the target of this information is those outside the university system who are seeking to obtain information to use for nefarious purposes. So with that, Mr. Chair, yes, I do have one more testifier on the amendment.
Bring them up.
That I added.
Chair Considine. Bring them up and check out.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is going to be real brief. What is a spear phishing attack?
Well, go ahead, Rick.
Sure. So phishing in general, email phishing is generally sending an email out spoofing that can go to anybody. Spear phishing is targeting you, Chair Considine, as an individual. So I'll learn things about you that would cause, and I'll include information in an email that would cause you to more likely click the link, open the attachment, perform an action. So it's targeted at you as an individual rather than a generalized email to multiple people.
Chair Cassidy.
Thank you for the explanation, and for the folks on this committee that dive into this stuff, I have a really great appreciation for you.
Thank you. Okay, who's the next testifier? Come on up. Who is it?
Oh, okay, well, anyone.
Bring it up. Please introduce yourself to the record.
So, Mr. Chair, while it's coming up, I'm just going to briefly explain that what the amendment was. So I had several U of M students approach me explaining, hey, Eric, across the country, not necessarily Minnesota yet, but across the country, higher education, colleges and universities are beginning to make it as a condition upon enrollment to install an app on the student's mobile device. Then, through Bluetooth capabilities on the mobile device and other capabilities, tracking the student's location as they traverse campus. That information being collected, being data mined, being shared with others is what the genesis of this amendment language that we adopted is. So with that background, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Apostolos Kotsolis. I'm a mechanical engineering student in the University of Minnesota. I will predominantly be speaking on the original bill rather than the amendment. On the amendment, Sam Parmakar will take over later. So I want to emphasize on the limited director information because of different requirements that students have in regards to reporting their data and reporting personal information to the university upon enrollment, specifically for F1 visas, which are the student visas. International students need to have their physical address constantly updated. What this means is, and among other information, what this means is that without having this limited directory and without having this automatic suppression, by default, the physical address of thousands of students in the University of Minnesota, roughly 10 to 15%, depending on how you estimate it, is always, at all times, publicly available. This is a federal requirement that has to do with how student visas work. Now, you can imagine that I will not dwell into all the problems that come with violations with regards to private to data security of the people, but you can imagine how much more crucial this is when it comes to people who come here at the age of 17, 18, 19, like I did, and the first time are in the country and are open to, for example, the spear phishing attacks that Representative Lucero just mentioned. And they're also vulnerable to the rise of pyramid schemes that we have seen on campus. They're vulnerable to scams, people calling them saying, hey, you were missing some payment to Social Security or something like that. Things and terms that they may not understand and they cannot default to their parents. Of course, these issues that relate to their students go beyond international students. Constituents from every one of your districts come to the University of Minnesota, and they voluntarily have this information given to the university, which is by default in many cases or was displayed. In fact, Mr. Representative, Mr. Chairman, if you go to UMN People Search, which is what the university uses as the directory, you could find your own daughter, and in fact, It took me 30 seconds to find the to find her residence hall. It's publicly available. This is just to tell you that you know this is really an issue, and it comes down to the right to privacy. It comes down to being secure from private or state actors. It comes down to simply the right to be left alone.
Thank you. Tell me your last name again.
Kotsolis. K-O-T-S-O-L-I-S.
Kotsolis. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kotsolis. Any questions for Mr. Kotsolis? Okay. Chair Liebling.
Just, Mr. Chair, not so much a question. I'm just very impressed by these young people. This is terrific.
Yeah. A credit to our higher educational system. Thank you. Representative Lucero. Oh, you got another testifier, too.
One last one, and my last testifier is on the amendment.
Okay. Come on up. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sam Parmakar. I'm a junior at the U, and I'm also the state government coordinator for the Minnesota Student Association, We are the undergraduate student government that represents the 35,000 students at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus.
How many undergrad out of the 35,000? How many are undergrad?
Sorry, so 35,000 undergrads. There's more in grad programs. Okay. Yeah.
Excellent. Go ahead. Thank you.
So as Representative Lucero mentioned, I'm here to speak on the amendment that has to do with student location data privacy. So this amendment addresses a growing trend of colleges and universities around the country that are contracting with private companies to actually collect student location data, like Representative Lucero mentioned, on apps, oftentimes without a student's knowledge or consent. So there are two main companies that universities typically contract with, Spotter EDU and Degree Analytics. And they operate off of a network of Bluetooth beacons that are installed around campus, and they kind of ping a student's location as soon as they're within range. According to the Washington Post, one company says it actually collects 6,000 location data points per student per day, so it's quite pervasive. This originally started as a way to track attendance in classes. Beacons would be installed in, like, classroom walls, but quickly grew to having beacons installed all around campus, so you can also track when a student's at their dorm, at the dining hall, at the library, et cetera. So currently, at least 40 universities in 13 different states are collecting student location data, including the University of North Carolina, Indiana University, Mizzou, and Columbia. I do want to stress that no universities in Minnesota are currently using these services now. However, it's a rapidly growing trend over the past few years, and we feel that there's benefit in the state getting out ahead of this problem. While these apps don't necessarily allow administrators to see a student's precise location at a given time, the Bluetooth check-in system allows universities to compile and analyze patterns of movement of individuals. In fact, patterns are actually the basis of their entire business model. I'm just going to read a direct quote from Degree Analytics website. They say, Degree Analytics uses a massive wireless data set at your university and applies our machine learning to automatically calculate hundreds of student behaviors, like class attendance, how students use campus facilities, or whether they're taking advantage of campus resources. With all this behavioral data at your fingertips, advisors and administrators can receive daily alerts and information from real student behaviors, so they'll know exactly how to support students. Furthermore, the company actually advertises its ability to group students by demographic, be that race, year in school, gender, et cetera, and compare their behavior patterns to their peers using algorithms. The company then uses these algorithms to generate what's called a risk score for individual students based off of the behavioral data it collects, and that's obviously of great concern. College students really shouldn't have to worry about living in a surveillance state when we're walking around campus. College should be a time for students to learn how to be independent and responsible for our own actions, and we should have a reasonable expectation of privacy from our administrators. Fundamentally, though, I think this is a problem in search, or a solution in search of a problem. We really don't need apps to be tracking attendance. I assure you that my literature professor knows I'm not in class right now, and she doesn't need an app to tell her that. just in closing, I do think that this language lays out some measured and specific rules for universities on how they can collect location data should they choose to contract with these companies. It requires a student to freely consent to having their location data collected by a university and stipulates that mandatory participation in data collection cannot be a condition of enrollment, receiving financial aid, or any sort of housing or meal contract. This will afford students some basic privacy protections and allows us to have actual autonomy when it comes to the information that our universities are collecting about us. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would encourage you to support the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for Mr. Parmarker? Chair Scott.
Well, Chair Lesh, you might want this app for your daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is just fascinating and scary and horrible all at the same time. There's no way that they need this information. This is kind of like the license plate reader of the college campus, and in a way connecting the dots of where you are. And so thank you, Representative Lucero, for helping these students out to pass some really needed legislation. You know, it's better, I think, for once we can say that we're ahead of something and being proactive. So thank you to the students that were here today.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Makes me want to go out and rent a Minority Report.
Rent? That was so 1990s. You don't rent those things.
Well,
download them.
Chair Lesh, I wasn't making reference to how
sorry.
Chair Lesh, I actually was thinking about making a reference to how much similarity there is between you and Neo in the Matrix, but I digress. For Representative
Lucero.
Lucero, thank you. I have a couple questions on page two. The young man, I think his first name is Tony, one of the testifiers, talked about contract law with regard to the dissemination or the availability to the contracts that are provided by technology providers. So the same applicability that we heard in the earlier bill would be applicable to this one as well. And to that point, the contract isn't between the student and the device, it's actually between the entity and the provider. So maybe a clarification in terms of may upon request, that type of thing, I'm just suggesting that. But then also lines 2.18 through 2.21 with regard to discovery of the breach, I don't find in this language a delineation between willful versus unknowing. The consequences could be similar, but for the act itself in terms of who might be involved, certainly from a litigation standpoint, you would want to identify if it was a malicious intent, willful, ignorant, or, you know, it's not bliss anymore. But I appreciate your considering, and Chair Les, just so you know, my daughter went to Winona State, and one of the provisos of going to Winona State is when you're a freshman is that they actually gave you either the choice of an Apple MacBook or a Dell PC, and they loaded it full, and you can go into the computer store anytime you had a problem, and they would fix it for you, right? At the end of your 4 years, you could take that computer with you for $100. The concern that I have just identified for myself is what went with that computer and that individual that has, because she still has it 10 years later, and tracking that all this time and the data sets that have been provided, shared, sold. So the enormity of the task that you are undertaking is appreciated.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero.
So, and you hit on some fantastic points. The first point is whether it be the K-12 or this one, you have technology providers in negotiations with academic institutions, and they're negotiating terms of a contract that have an impact on parents and students. But the parents and students are not party to these negotiations. Right, that's why it's so critically important that these contracts be made available. So what is it that parents and students are being, you know, information about them is being negotiated? We need to make that available. Number two, when it comes to the location. So there were some questions under the K-12 bill, for example. This is why location tracking prohibition is in there. It's so that students, you can't grab all this information and build a profile. To the third point, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, one of the practices I do is if you've ever purchased a laptop or device from a store or however you acquired it, the very first thing I do, even if it's a brand new device, I wipe it to get rid of all of the default software that they have on there. I wipe it and I do a fresh install of the operating system so that there's none of that stuff on there. In that case, because big data is a multi-billion dollar industry, imagine the information that's being harvested on our students and the profiles that are being built through their academic K-12 career. Then when they graduate, how rich and valuable that information is, right? And then if they can continue on through their college years, and then after they graduate college, in the example you're using, into adulthood and into their professional career, what information might still be on that device, tracking, sending information back to ever create a stronger profile on each of us as individuals is very scary. And one of the examples I used in previous testimony, if you remember the Target example, for those who saw my previous PowerPoint, data mining, Target, so just real brief, the story is, and this is real, probably goes back 6 or 7 years now, a father who had a daughter, the daughter, Target, sent coupons in the mail to the daughter. The father opened up the mail, the letter, I think, and there was coupons promoting diapers and baby food and or things like that. And the father became outraged. He went to Target manager and said, why are you promoting unmarried, you know, activity? And he found out several days later that his daughter was indeed pregnant. How did Target know that? It's because data analytics, behavioral patterns, the purchasing patterns can indicate more likely than not that a woman is pregnant. So that's why patterns, whether it be location or all of our consumer purchasing, everything we're doing, these profiles are so incredibly rich, and where it's going, we need to contain it. Finally, to the final point that Representative Scott brought up, because this isn't happening in the state of Minnesota yet, that is all the more reason. It's, as we've heard in the previous bill, it's a much more difficult uplift to get something that's already out there to contain it. But to try and get in front of and be proactive on something that isn't happening yet is so much easier, why it's imperative to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. We have one last question from Representative Mahler. And then we have a testifier, Meredith Fergus. Ms. Fergus, are you here? Okay. And then we have your bill, House File 103, which we're already 10 minutes over, and we haven't even gotten to that yet. Is there anyone here in the audience who wants to be heard on House File 103? Okay, that's good news, because we're probably going to bump it to the next next time. Later, whenever. We're going to bump it to later. Okay, so you get two Lucero days in judicial. Okay? And with that, yeah, I'll bring donuts again, too. Representative Mahler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really quickly, Representative Lucero. So I didn't see any kind of exception in here for like a missing person report for location data. If there was a university had a missing student, that happened at my son's college again. So if there could be some sort of exception for that, I'd like to see that. But thank you for bringing this bill.
Okay. I'm not going to give you time for closing comments since we're already over and a lot of comments have been made. All the discussion has been had by the committee. So we're going to have, Ms. Fergus, come on down from the Office of Higher Education. Welcome. Please introduce yourself. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero. I am Meredith Fergus. I'm the Manager of Research in the State Longitudinal Data System for the Office of Higher Education, and as such, I'm one of the staff charged with data privacy for the office. I'll be extremely brief. We have some questions. We have reached out to the institutions to see how this language would impact current practices, and we haven't heard back on that, so I just wanted to make you aware. Secondly, in our read of Chapter 13, we do believe that this may establish a higher standard for higher education than in K-12. We don't see similar language for K-12 suppressing these data elements. And so we do have some questions about that. Secondly, we would note that many of our colleges do already have limited directory information policies, and therefore this is a common practice. The University of Minnesota is, of course, the exception. And fourth, in terms of the technology amendment, it does reference private institutions. And you should know that under 13.32, subdivision 1, the definition of educational data does not include private institutions. They are only subject to federal law, not state law, for data privacy. And so you may have a conflict there. And that is all I have. Thank you,
Excellent.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Fergus. Any questions for Ms. Fergus? Seeing none, then thank you very much. We'll move to a vote on this. Representative Lucero moved that House File 2232, as amended, be recommended be re-referred to the Higher Education Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. You are on your way to higher education. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Lucero. And as I stated, we're already, 13 minutes over, so we're going to lay over House File 103 for later consideration. Thank you, members. There being no other business before the committee today, committee is adjourned.